It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dive into the business climate in our state and learn about a movie theater enterprise with deep roots here. Milwaukee-based Marcus Corporation was founded nearly 90 years ago during the Great Depression with the purchase of a single movie theater in Ripon. Call in with your questions about the future of the movie theater business, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Greg Marcus is president and CEO of the Marcus Corporation, which operates two divisions, Marcus Theaters and Marcus Hotels and Resorts. Greg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So your company owns or operates more than 80 theater locations in 17 states. What is your vision for the future of Marcus Theaters?
My vision for the future of Marcus Theaters? Well, look, we will... We're a place where people get together to consume entertainment and to be together as a community and to get off that couch, and that's what it has been and that's what it will continue to be. Now, what that entertainment is, you know, I can't tell you for sure. There may be less movies, but there's going to be concerts and maybe comedy and, you know, we do the Metropolitan Opera, so there'll be maybe there'll be different, you know, a wider variety of content, but the concept of people getting together to consume entertainment outside of their house, believe it or not, to those who don't seem to get off their couch, has been going on for, you know, millennia. And so, you know, it's the good thing is it's, you know, people talk about it. So let's not beat around the bush here. People are like, well, we can stream everything into our houses. Yeah, you can. But frankly, there's really very little difference between streaming and TV, except there's a little more availability of product on streaming now than TV used to have. But the experience is still the same. And you can't replicate that experience when you go to a theater, and it's not just about good films. I sat there last night. I saw a movie called A Man Called Otto, and we all sat and cried in that theater together. It was a moving experience. And you know what? Sitting on your sofa crying by yourself, alone, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, I'm going to get to the streaming issue in just a bit. But first of all, what I heard from you a bit earlier was diversification. Movie theaters having to diversify themselves, find new avenues for revenue streams to bring in audiences that are maybe not entirely reliant on a box office and concessions. What does that diversification mean for Marcus, to your business?
Well, I mean, look, it's good to have more product. But let's not be confused here. 80% to 90% is still going to be going to the movies. You know, what's happening, I think, is that there may be, and I don't even know yet what it's going to look like. We don't know. We're in a rebuilding phase, and we don't know what we're going to get back to. We aren't back. This year we were two-thirds of the way back to 2019, as opposed to, and next year we should see a little bit more. We'll come a little bit closer than we were the year before that. I don't know what it'll be. We never know until the movies play. But there's going to be more product, and we're already off to a start. There's more product already. As I said, I was at the movies last night. Last year at this time, if you'd already seen Spider-Man, there was nothing to see. So there was more product already. But where does that end up? I don't know. And then the question is, okay, how do you fill the gap? What do you do? And so that means there'll be other stuff. By the way, it doesn't mean there will always be concessions. That's part of the experience. Sitting there eating some popcorn, but you can eat popcorn or some candy or a burger or pizza watching a concert watching the Metropolitan Opera as much as you can, watching a movie. So
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk with Greg Marcus, CEO of the Milwaukee-based Marcus Corporation, getting an inside look on the movie business and what it means for Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Laura in Arpin is joining in. Laura, what's on your mind?
Good morning. A couple of weeks ago, I just went to the first movie I've gone to in years and years. I come from the generation that went to the movie theater all the time for entertainment. But as I've gotten older, I deal with hearing loss. And our local theater now has devices to provide closed captions. And so that's what finally took me back to the theater, because I could go and I could enjoy the movie without irritating everybody asking, what did they say? What did they say? So it was really fun, and I was so glad to get back into the theater.
Laura, what did you see, may I ask?
We went to see the new Avatar movie.
Oh, sure. Laura, thank you for the call. Greg, you know, an assistive closed caption assistive device made all the difference for Laura.
Well, I want to ask your president if she liked it.
Laura, did you like it?
So the graphics are fantastic. I just wish they had updated the story a little bit compared to the original.
Oh, thank you for that. Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, I love that movie. I really enjoyed it. I was a little skeptical when I went in to go see it. I was thinking, man, 3 hours long, you know, blue people, this is what is, you know, and because I'm getting older, and I guess I'm a little more skeptical, and I loved the movie. I was like, wow. And my son, who's in his early 20s, he was equally skeptical. He said, Dad, I really love that movie. Okay, good. But yeah, no, we do have the closed caption devices so that people with hearing disabilities can see the story and hear and enjoy the story with everybody. And I think that technology is going to get better. You know, look, that technology was making progress and getting better and better as we pre-pandemic. And I think in the pandemic, everything went out the door. And I suspect as we get back to a more normal operating environment, that's going to make even more, we'll make more advances in that.
How dependent is your type of business on the avatars of the world, on these big films that are meant for theaters?
It's dependent on all the movies. You need a full slate of movies, and that includes the avatars of the world, but it includes the Man Called Otto's of the world and the Megans of the world, which just opened this week, the small horror films. You need the horror films. You need the dramas. You need the comedies. You need the tentpoles. And you need a variety of tentpoles. It can't all be superhero movies. You need superhero movies, but you need an Avatar. You need a Top Gun. You need a Mission Impossible coming up this summer. You know, you need a whole variety of that, too. You know, we, at the end of the day, where I was talking about before, what we need, the movies business is a numbers game. And I always tell people, people will sit around and they'll look at, there's two ways to figure out, to try. And there's an old saying in Hollywood, when I come back to trying, it's everything in Hollywood's an R&D except the sequel, which means you just don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work with the audiences. But what you do know is if you make enough movies, if you roll the dice enough times, that you'll have you make 10 movies, two will be really good, two will be awful, and six will be sort of in the middle. But you need all 10 to figure out which we rank. We need 20 or 30 to make it happen. And the truth is we need close to 100 in a given year. And so, like this year, we were down in the low 70s for releases over 2,000 screens. So that's the problem. And I'll tell you a really interesting statistic for people who say, well, nobody's going to the movies anymore. The average movie in 2019 that went wide over 2,000 screens did about $98 million in box office. In 22, a little over $100 million. So it really is a case of if you build it, they will come.
Marcus Corporation CEO Greg Marcus with us on the future of the movie theater experience, where it's headed. Call in with your questions about going to the movies or what makes sense for holding your attention and pulling it toward the big screens. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We get an inside look at the movie theater business with Milwaukee headquartered Marcus Corporation, over 80 theaters, 17 states, including, of course, here in Wisconsin. Movie fans, join in with questions about the theater experience, your take on the box office, 800-642-1234. Greg Marcus is CEO of Marcus Corporation and stays with us. Let's go to Chris now in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
As you know, films are generally rated G, PG, 13, R, NC-17, and PG. Question. I am concerned that theater chains continue to not provide NC-17 films to adults. This has an unfortunate ripple effect back to production. Specifically, edits are imposed on directors, and art suffers. Films get dumbed down. Will Marcus make a commitment to provide NC-17 films to adults?
Chris, thank you for the question. Greg?
It depends. Well, commit to playing what people want to see and that there's enough of an audience for something. You know, it's interesting. As I'm listening to him ask the question, that was a really interesting question that's never been asked before. So I'm going to have to say, I have to go with he has some interesting questions. I think about the answer. But but I will say it's a little bit of the chicken and the egg kind of thing to some extent, because I can't remember the last time anybody came to us and said, would you play an NC-17 movie? So I'm not sure if it's us or, you know, because once again, it goes back to that point that I was making. It's about having it. We're not getting enough films. So, you know, it'll all depend on the community and what the movie is. And, you know, we're not the ones making them necessarily. And I can't remember the last time somebody offered it to us.
And you don't have control over how a film gets rated. So it basically comes to you, I would imagine, as a package. How do you decide what films to take?
We have bookers who look at the films and review them but frankly, you know, most of the Hollywood movies and even beyond, you know, we're playing most of what comes our way. If a distributor is distributing it, part of distributing a movie, there's two parts to it. One part is the making of the movie, the film, the production of it. But the other part is the marketing of it. And if they're going to spend the money on marketing something that almost has sort of it's saying, we believe that there's enough in this, that this is a high enough quality movie that it will attract an audience that we can spend the millions of dollars to market it. Because marketing a movie nationally, which is what has to happen, is very, very expensive.
Let's bring in Nancy now in Madison. Nancy, you want to bring up digital.
I just want to bring up the fact that I'd be going to the movies. I'm old. I'd be going to the movies if I knew where they were and when they were, because I no longer can see them written anywhere in any newspaper or weekly. So that's why I don't go anymore. And I don't go because why would I pay online to go to a movie? And why would I pay to get a seat for a movie? I just want to go, but there's no way to know when and where and what. And I'm old, and maybe there are a few other old people who would like that also.
Nancy, thank you for that. Nancy, referring to how movies used to be listed in the newspaper.
Yeah, sure. You know, look, I hear as she said, I thought, well, maybe we should be advertising and look, as we're looking for all of our customers and age is we, you know, I'll come back to that in 2 seconds, age, but we want the customer to we want to figure out as many ways to reach them as we can. You don't have to buy them online, Nancy, and you don't have to see, and frankly, yes, I guess if you're going to go to the, we do have an issue with, we do assign seats. But frankly, I gotta be honest. If unless you go when we're the most busy, you know, if you go to Avatar right now on a Friday night, yeah, you need to get your seat ahead of time. But Nancy, go see A Man Called Otto. You'd love it. And I'm gonna tell you right now, when I went last night, Were there people in the theater? Yeah, but you pretty much had your pick of seats. And so you go to the box office, and you'll select your seat right there as opposed to just walking to another 20 yards into the auditorium. So you can buy the tickets at the theater. You can pretty much pick your seat right when you're there. And I would say that, you know, but we do want that older audience, and we need to find ways to reach them. But I would tell you, I just saw a stat in the 35-plus demo. That was over half the ticket buyers for Top Gun, as well as Elvis and The Woman King this year. 57% were Elvis, actually, and half for The Woman King. So we are attracting an older audience. We just need more product. And I would just want to say, because it goes back to this whole thing of, I do believe people think, oh, you know what? I can, again, it goes back to that thing. I can watch tent poles, you know, at home. I mean, in the theater, I can watch the smaller stuff at home. It's different. And I think people forget what it's like to go to the movies. Because I would tell people for a long time, I forgot what it was like to go to the movies. I had, I had forgotten what it was like to sit there with in the dark, putting my phone down, not looking at anything else, not pausing it to go do something. I put myself in a cocoon and made myself sort of a subject to the entire experience. And I don't care, you know, the sound is not the same. The 100-foot, the 40-foot, even our smallest screen at 40-some-odd feet, 35, 40 feet, it's a lot bigger than your 100-inch TV. And so I think if you're going to go out, and people want to go out, you know, the other business we have is the hotel business. And
I do want to get back to the business side here for just a moment. I'm going to reintroduce you, Greg Marcus, CEO of Milwaukee-based Marcus Corporation. You know, you're talking about getting back to 2/3 of what you were in 2019. We saw federal funds pouring into Wisconsin and then into the tourism and entertainment industry, receiving millions of dollars in government aid. What effect has that assistance had on your company's operations and its decisions?
Well, I'll tell you, there were two kinds of aid. There was big federal aid, and there was a big thing amount of state aid that came from the federal government. Frankly, the amount that came directly, that there was a thing called Save Our Stages, and that was very beneficial to the smaller companies because it wasn't available to public companies. Now, I got to be honest. I'm not sure I see the distinction between a private company and a public company, especially one like ours. We're not a giant public company. We didn't have access to the same capital markets as others, and yet it was deemed appropriate to keep our cultural institutions like movie theaters in, you know, help them get through what was unprecedented and not their fault, right? I mean, we were closed, unprecedented. We'd never been closed for, you know, almost 6 months. And we employ a lot of people. We give a lot of kids their first jobs. We are an important piece of the state economy, and we make the life, you know, better here. And we paid taxes forever. We've been a tax paying company for a long time.
How did you stay afloat?
We had to borrow money. We had to use our net operating losses, which is that we were generating, we could get some tax refunds. Because we were a taxpayer for so long, and we did get some. And I would say the Evers administration was great, and directed some of that funding to companies like ours. It wasn't huge, but every dollar helped. But we're still dealing with the challenges that brought on. But part of it was because we, as a company, goes back to, again, how do you operate? Distinction, public or private, no distinction. I know people think the big bad public company. I'm not exactly sure why, but I can think of bad actors, but I can think of bad private and public actors.
I just want to run one more thing by you on the business side, because we've been talking with CEOs on our show for a while, and they've all brought up workforce challenges. Is Marcus having trouble finding enough workers?
Oh, yeah. It's getting better. We are noticing it's starting to get better. It's very challenging. But, you know, we've had it. We've the pay has gone up as we responded to the market. But it's always challenging. It can be seasonal, that makes it even harder.
And a few seconds left here. Why does Marcus choose to remain headquartered in Milwaukee?
You know what? It's a great place to exist. It was a great place to raise the family. I grew up here. Williamson's a great city. Our hotels are all here. I do want to talk for a minute about our hotel business because it's a big part. It's an important part of our business, you know, whether it's the St. Kate or the Pfister or the Hilton or the Madison Hilton or the Grand Geneva. You know, these have been very important to where we are, and we believe it's important to be where our businesses are.
That makes sense. Greg, Marcus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Greg Marcus is president and CEO of the Marcus Corporation, which is based in Milwaukee. It has two divisions, Marcus Theaters and Marcus Hotels and Resorts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss how to protect young athletes when they play contact sports like football, like hockey, and the latest research on head injuries. Call in with your questions about safety in sports, prevention, and response at the youth level, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Kuchera is director of the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research and an associate professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Science at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good morning. And Tracy Sneddon with us, a clinical associate professor at UW-Madison School of Nursing with research in the area of child and adolescent concussions. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. I am excited to be here.
Good morning. So let's start with doctors releasing Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin from a hospital to continue recovering at home. You know, after we witnessed what happened on the field last week and Hamlin suffering cardiac arrest, I want to ask both of you, what is on your mind about Hamlin's case and recovery, what it tells us? Tracy, you first.
Sure. I think we would all agree that Hamlin's case has been extremely high profile in the media and in the public and has gained attention from everyone, sport and non-sport. And I think the greatest gain, if I could say, from this terrible incident that has come out with a very positive outcome thus far is the attention on what emergency procedures look like and the need to have those individuals on field immediately. So as we saw in that game, high profile NFL in general, those games have 29 medical personnel on the field at any time, so able to respond. Sadly, not every sport, every level, most especially youth, has that response. And so I think bringing the attention to the need to understand CPR and emergency protocols is really, really great. And I can't emphasize enough how wonderful the positive outcome for Damar has been for everybody.
Kristen, what comes up for you?
Witnessing and watching that event, first of all, thinking about, the athlete and the players and the other coaches and other providers that are there, as well as family members. But one thing I thought of is that our center tracks catastrophic sport injuries, and which would include deaths and events that lead to disability. And, one thing we know from our research is that these types of events are rare, which is good. We want them to be rare, but when they do occur, Tracy said, a prompt response is critical. And so this was, as said before, a great example of a situation where there were a lot of emergency medical personnel and just medical personnel there to respond. CPR, AEDs, automatic external defibrillators were there. This was just a great example of how this prompt response can provide a positive outcome. And we really want to see these kinds of responses in the lower levels of play.
I would imagine, too, it was a wake-up call for teams at all levels of sport, you know, as they say, whoa, we have to review our practices and policies. What should youth coaching staff be doing in the aftermath of this? Tracy, go ahead.
Sure. I think we saw even from media reports that that was almost instantaneous, that field level teams, coaches, athletic trainers were again reviewing their emergency procedures. And I think that was our first response to what occurred there, that although this is something that is part of the training, part of the renewal process for emergencies, but I think it really put it front and center to what do we do? What do we have access to? Again, some schools at the youth level and club level don't even have an athletic trainer available to them on the field. They don't have an AED, as we just heard, you know, mentioned from Kristen. So I think it's about also bringing light to the gaps in recognition of emergencies like this and how important they are to good outcomes.
Kristen, where are the gaps that you see in your research? How adequately prepared are staff at the high school level, at the college level, to respond to injuries?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we do know from research is about, and I'll speak to the high school level, about 70% of high schools have access to a certified athletic trainer. This research comes from the National Athletic Trainers Association and the Corey Stringer Institute. It's called the ATLAS program. And you can go online and you can see which high schools have a certified athletic trainer on staff or have an athletic trainer contracted. So we do know that not all schools have access to an athletic trainer. We would like to see all schools having, you know, the access to AEDs. And we know that having an AED within 3 minutes of an event is very critical for a positive outcome, survival. So that's another really important piece for us to think about. And then, you know, Tracy's emphasis on reviewing our emergency action plans, you know, that review should be taking place annually and, you know, should be a pretty thorough review so everyone knows their role and what they need to do in the event of emergency so that everything happens really promptly. Because, you know, as we saw, these events are very, very stressful and scary.
But in the absence of an athletic trainer or a robust staff, if you will, you know, for a particular team, and especially at the youth level, who should be responsible for the sideline, you know, recognition and response to injuries in practices and games? Who should it be assigned to, Kristen?
Yeah, that is a great question because, again, we know not all schools have access to an athletic trainer. You know, coaches receive CPR as well as a training in AED use. I can say that from the high school level. I'm not exactly certain in terms of the competitive youth leagues exactly what those rules are in terms of trainings, but I do know that coaches do get that type of training. And then just, again, ensuring that we're reviewing emergency protocols and assigning roles to the individuals who are there so that things can happen. I do know it's really it's a great thing to say, right? Have an AED within 3 minutes. And I know it's much more difficult to make that happen, you know, than I make it sound. So I do think that is a challenge for a lot of us to be working together on.
Tracy, in the area of head injuries, which you really know, how critical is it for coaches to be required to take concussion education and training or like a course on concussions?
Yeah, important transition. So thanks for bringing this topic to mind. In all states, I believe it was about the year 2015, there is now, you know, concussion law. And concussion law has a variety of components within it, some of which in some states include certain levels of training to certain coach and field level members. So the importance of recognizing a concussion is of greatest priority. And I think we've come a long way with teaching coaches, families, even athletes themselves about recognizing the signs and symptoms of a concussion and even those mechanisms that might produce that injury. So, you know, through legislation and through overall public education and awareness, we've really gained some ground on concussion in general. And it all starts, like I said, with awareness and recognition. Now, we still have a lot of work to do in access for care for these individuals who do appear to have a concussion. And some of my work has found that there are disparities in access to care. Those who are student athletes who have private insurance, who identify as Caucasian, have much higher access to care post-injury. So I think it's a very complicated question that starts at recognition, but then goes through care. And what does that care look like based on evidence? And how does it affect outcomes of these different groups that might have those disparities?
That's so important to point out. And also to hear you say that diagnosis is only a starting point because there is a trajectory after that.
Yes, indeed. I will expand with, you know, I grew up in northern Wisconsin, where the access isn't as robust as it might be in some of the bigger cities in Wisconsin or across the U.S. And that's where some of those disparities are just glaring.
Talking about sports injuries with Tracy Sneddon, clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing, and Kristen Kuchera, director of the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Kristen, your research center's preliminary data for 2022 says at least 9 student athletes died last year playing football or in football-related activities. How typical are these numbers compared to previous years?
Thank you for asking that. We're currently working on finalizing our annual report. We put out an annual report, among others, every year looking at catastrophic football injuries as well as to other sports, but this is our report on football fatalities. And what I would say is that normally what we would see in terms of football on average is that we see about 10 to 11 deaths per year. And that is an average from the last 5 years. And when we think about these events, we think about the ones that are due to traumatic injuries, so such as a catastrophic traumatic brain injury, or in a case of something like commotio cordis, where someone is hit in the chest. We see 2 to 3 on average deaths, and this is the high school and the college level combined. When we think of events like sudden cardiac arrest, not due to a traumatic event, or exertional heat stroke, there are about 8 to 9 events on average per year. So, excuse me, we have, you know, these numbers are a little lower than what we have seen on average over the past 5 years, is what I would say. We do see more of these events at the high school level, but there are a lot more athletes playing football. Almost 1 million athletes play football in the United States. And we have about, 75 to 80,000 collegiate level football players.
How likely is your data accurately capturing the actual number, you know, considering all the sports facilities and all the teams out there? How are you able to really capture this?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Our center in the past, and I would even say now, has relied heavily on searching the online available media sources. So certain search engines online. And so we are reliant on these events being reported online for us to capture them. We do have a website called sportinjuryreport.org, and it's a place where anyone can go and report just the basic details of a catastrophic sport injury. It is really challenging to ensure that we're capturing all of them. And, you know, I would say that we don't. I'm at this point, and we're really working hard to try to partner with sport organizations and get the word out about this work so that we can get better capture of these events.
That is UNC Chapel Hill Department of Exercise and Sports Science Associate Professor Kristen Kuchera. And we have UW-Madison Clinical Associate Professor in Nursing Tracy Sneddon. Colin, with your questions about youth sport injuries, where they go from here, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Should you keep your child away from contact sports or let them play on? What risks is your family willing to take for the love of the game? Still time to talk about sports injuries, 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison Clinical Associate Professor Tracy Sneddon and Kristen Kuchera, who leads the National Center for Catastrophic Sport Injury Research at UNC Chapel Hill. They stay with us. Let's bring on a call, Katie in Duluth, Minnesota. Katie, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a cardiologist in Duluth, Minnesota, and I see, you know, people of all ages, but I just wanted to emphasize with this conversation about how important it is for everybody, not just the coaches, to learn hands-only CPR in a case of an emergency. It's something that is easy for anybody to do, and anybody could save a life, not just those who are trained in, you know, basic life support or who go through more of the extensive training like a lot of medical personnel do.
Katie, thank you so much for elevating that. Tracy, hands-only CPR and the importance of knowing it. Go ahead.
Sure, Katie, such a great point. Thanks for calling in. And I think we're hearing and seeing much more of interested individuals who are now wanting to learn hands-only CPR and have seen the value of it and what your average person at any event, sport or non-sport, can do to save someone's life. So again, like we just heard, thank you for elevating the importance of what might appear to be something that is a really easy contribution to a terrible event we all experienced.
I want to turn back, Tracy, to concussions and how do medical staff at sports games diagnose concussions? What is that process like?
I think it depends on the level of the staff that's field level. So when an individual appears to have some signs and symptoms that we have seen from the literature and study after study that makes us think someone may have a concussion, that begins the process of evaluation. We generally say that not necessarily is a concussion diagnosed at the time of injury, at the time on the field, the court, the pitch, whatever the sport is. So I think more so it's recognizing those potential signs and symptoms that signal a concussion may have occurred, and then going on for continued medical evaluation away from the game, away from the chaos, and away from the eyes that are all watching. So I think that's what starts the process, and hoping that answers your question. Kate.
Are youth at high risk for concussions?
I think we have to look broadly at that big question you just asked. And I think we have to look by sport. We spent a lot of time today talking about football as a major contact sport at the youth, high school, college, pro level. But there are also other sports that can, you know, have that higher potential for concussion, and that would be women's soccer, which has a very high concussion rate when we compare it to other sports. And we can't forget about sports that some might not come to mind, which is things like cheer. But also lacrosse, wrestling, basketball, ice hockey are all part of this collection. And when you say, are youth at higher risk? I wouldn't say, and the literature doesn't say they're at higher risk for concussion. I think it's all about the mechanism of injury, their growing brain, and what is occurring at the practice site that is maybe, you know, contributing to those hits.
Kristen, your data says there were 3 direct fatalities in high school football last year. All 3 happened due to catastrophic injuries to the brain. What do you see in the data, and how can schools better prevent these severe head injuries?
Thank you for asking that question. I think one of the things that's most important that Tracy mentioned was that every state has a what we call a concussion law, a law that's been enacted to help manage concussion. And there are various pieces of these laws, things like no same return to play once you have been diagnosed with a concussion and you only return after you've been cleared by an appropriate medical professional. There's also concussion education as part of these laws so that families and athletes know about concussion, how to recognize if they have one. And then thinking about the other types of things, which is, you know, return to learn. I think some states have had some pieces put into that. But from our center standpoint, knowing the state law and ensuring that we follow that state law, once an athlete has a concussion, if they do go back to play prior to healing, they could be at risk for an event called second impact syndrome. And this is a catastrophic event that could occur if someone returns to play too soon and then suffers a hit. So those, I think, are some of the really important pieces. And then, of course, having access to certified athletic trainers who are trained to recognize symptoms and evaluate concussions among all athletes and active individuals.
Kristen Kuchera, director of the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research there. Tracy Sneddon with us, clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing. This is really difficult. Lucille from Wautoma called in. Great-grandson had five concussions, Lucille says here, and some with sports injuries, others at gym classes or outside activities like skiing. Two had knocked the great-grandson unconscious, and they died by suicide before they turned 16. And Lucille has a very hard time talking about it, but said that the family thinks the only explanation is the concussions. Tracy, what are your thoughts?
What a hot and very important question. And I think we're seeing more and more, thankfully, research that's being done on, first of all, the psychological effects of concussion itself. And then you mentioned in this case, the effects of repetitive concussion on youth and all age groups. I think when we think about this terrible situation for Lucille and the family, I want to acknowledge that it must be unbearable, you know, to have experienced that and then the loss. So sending, of course, sympathies and condolences for that terrible outcome. When we look at the research and how it might relate to those who have mental health, psychiatric concerns, post-injury, it's really difficult to determine what's the contribution of those head injuries. And it's not my area of expertise, completely honest with you. There's much in the media and the literature about CTE.
And much more
encephalopathy. Yes.
Much more to learn. And we're out of time. Thank you both for joining us.
Yes, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tracy Sneddon, clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing, Kristen Kuchera at the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.